Broadcasting from Manhattan Beach and the World Wide Web, you're listening to CHSR, HealthyLife.net.
As a service to our listeners, this program is for general information and entertainment purposes only. CHSRHealthyLife.net does not recommend, endorse, or object to the views, products, or topics expressed or discussed by show hosts or their guests. We suggest you always consult with your own personal, medical, financial, or legal advisor.
Welcome. You're listening to Way of the Dreamer. This is the place where we affirm the value of dreams, coincidence, and imagination, which people sometimes dismiss, but can be sources of remarkable guidance in life, relaxation, entertainment, healing, access to deeper worlds. We have a wonderful guest today. His name is Willem Hartman. He is a teacher of shamanic dreaming. I think I can put it that way. He studied with me. He studied with my friend Sandra Ingerman and other shamanic teachers. He has become a very important and very effective and very gifted teacher of shamanism and dream work in Europe. He's Dutch, and of course, like the Dutch, he speaks four languages fluently and can pick up any number of other ones. So we're putting him on in English today because most of us Anglos aren't too good at this. Welcome, Willem.
Well, thank you. First of all, I'd like to say that I'm probably very good in making lots of errors in many languages.
Well, that's your typical charming modesty. I've seen you in action because we did a 3-year dream teacher training together, and I've seen you in action in other contexts, and I've seen how well you lead people and how determined and devoted you are to technique. You tell me that vivid dreams and visions led you to study spirituality from childhood. And as a young adult, you felt a strong call towards religion, finding resonance with the Quakers. Now, I find that very interesting because you know more about this than I do by far. But the Quakers have a very important history as dreamers. I mean, dream work, I understand, has always been very important for the Quaker community. And I'm thinking recently about the first professor of anthropology in the English language, first professor of anthropology at Oxford, Sir Edward Tyler, who gave us the theory of animism in a vast work in the 1870s. He came from a Quaker family. I don't know that he was a practicing Quaker as a man, but there's another example, and he's the one who told us, even his all sounds a bit dated now, he told us that it's through dreaming amongst so-called savage peoples, so we discover the reality of the soul and the reality of the afterlife, because people discover in indigenous societies that something leaves the body in dreams and it comes back, and so that becomes evidence for the reality of the soul and becomes a source of religion, I mean, to put it very briefly. And this is coming from a man who grew up Quaker and then reads a lot of books and gave us a theory which is still around. Tell us briefly, a little bit, if you would, about dreams and visions that might have helped to shape your life or been turning points in your life.
Well, that's an interesting question. I thought of all the questions you could ask me. I never thought of that one. but I was ready for the impossible questions. I think my dream days in the beginning were nightmares. I had a lot of nightmares. And they were so intense that when I was very young, I basically refused to sleep, which turned me into an insomniac. But at one age, somewhere in my childhood, maybe I was 12 or 13, I decided that it wasn't a problem. It was the way I was reacting to it, although I didn't put it in those words. But I understood this. The dream itself, the nightmare itself, wasn't a problem. It's the way I was dealing with it. And so one of my first things that I did was stop taking it as an attack, also thinking that I do not have some sort of a handicap. I'm just being called to dream. And it's a positive approach. It's more connected. I have the feeling that bit by bit I started to communicate through some lucid dreams, actually, or semi-lucid dreams, with what was hunting me. And this kind of turned it around. And so I've always had an opening to dreaming, but it expanded to also dreaming during daytime, meaning I don't have to be asleep. I started practicing daydreaming, different types of meditation, exercising my intuition, connecting to coincidences. I did not know about the word synchronicity, of course, but I could try to connect to the a living universe around me. And it's nice that you were talking about animism and the person who brought the this Quaker man who brought the word animism. Is that bit by bit I start to feel that, yeah, the world is animated. There is something there. It kind of makes sense.
Very interesting. Now, how old were you, would you say, when you discovered that you didn't need to be the victim of nightmares? You could make choices inside the dream state and change what was going on. How old were you when you made that discovery?
It has to be between 13 and 15 years old.
Yes, that would be a good age.
It has to be around there.
I had a comparable moment when I was 14, and it started with what people call sleep paralysis, so that's a very bad name for it, because you're not actually asleep, but your muscle groups might be shut down. And I'm attacked in my bed by a horrible hag-like woman.
Yes.
She forces me to have sex with her. I'm 14. I'm very innocent. She's not attractive, but that's not the only thing. I'm horrified by this seeming act of sex. And then she changes into beautiful, beautiful girl, maiden, and I've become conscious, and I've sort of gone with this. We go off into the woods, and I realize later on that I probably met Kali, or a version of Kali, about whom I knew very little. But after that, it came to me that really we don't have to be victims, you know, even if you're being attacked. Maybe if you go with it and go on with it, you can come through. And this week, I've been looking at the life of a Korean shaman, a mudang, and some of them are basically ritualists, but some do a lot of work with dreams. I was looking at a transformative episode in her childhood, which was like yours. She discovered that, having been terrified by a series of dreams in which monstrous things are flying at her from the sky, flying tigers and nameless monsters and other beasts, she realized, okay, instead of running away, I can see if I can meet them and be with them and fly with them and play with them, and that changes everything. And then the other thing that you said, which is, so that's a wonderful teaching example that you gave us from your life, and the second teaching example is that we don't need to close our eyes in order to dream. The world around us is a dream. And this is understood and taught in many philosophies, Eastern and some Western as well. And in indigenous cultures, by my observation, I mean, it's really rather seamless. You don't just dream with your eyes closed. You dream in the living land, recognizing that everything is alive and conscious. Anthropologists have become very edgy about the word animist. It's not very popular amongst the academic anthropologists. But it's coming back under these complicated tags that they invent to sound respectable. So they talk about, if you haven't heard this, wait for it, multinaturalist perspectivism. How about that for an elegant phrase? This comes out of Brazilian ethnography. Yeah. And basically, it's about animism. But because they don't want to use the word animism, they now talk about multinatural perspectivism, which means that in an indigenous culture or amongst people who see things and dream things the same way, you can actually shift back and forth between the perspective of a human, a jaguar, a tree, and so on. So your story is very interesting. Yes, go on. I'm sorry.
No, I always wonder why change something when it works, if the word animism works. At the same time, what you described is very interesting because it kind of details it a bit more. It pinpoints certain elements that are interesting and that maybe you don't find with a cover all terminology like animism.
Right. And, well, it's also accompanied, we won't do a whole discussion about the state of anthropology.
No.
I'm not an anthropologist, but I read a lot of anthropology, and I know a lot of anthropologists. And it's interesting how they have evolved from people like Tyler, who sat in a study and read books, which I'm in favor of, by the way. I sit in the study and read books most of the time. But, of course, they became field workers. Not only field workers, but they became what they call participatory observers. In other words, you know, they're getting together with the different peoples, sharing things with them, and more they're sharing their own dreams, and then entering the dreaming of the people that they're studying, and which puts it into a completely different category. Because if you're living with the people, whether or not you're an anthropologist or an explorer in consciousness or a spiritual tourist, I mean, if you're dreaming with the different people and dreaming into their dream worlds, I mean, well, my goodness, how much more deeply could you get to know a different people than if you're actually entering the landscapes of their dreams, which are likely to be very different from the ones you grew up with? And, of course, your theories, your Euro-American theories, are probably not going to count for very much for the people who know that a dream world is a living world. It's a life world. It has its realities and its consequences. So as we talk, we start talking about different cultures, you've been very drawn in your life by Nordic, by Scandinavian cultures,
and yes,
I have it in my blood. I'm mostly Scandinavian according to my DNA, but for many years I sort of kept away with it from it because I really didn't like the dark side of what I thought was, you know, Viking belief and practice with blood eagle sacrifices and so on. But then Tolkien turned up in one of my dreams and said I had to study Scandinavian mythology, and I didn't do so immediately, but I came to it. My knowledge is not as deep as yours, but I've been very interested to discover how deep dreaming is in the minds and the literatures of the northern people. So talk a little bit about what you feel in contact with. And you teach some form of Sedra, you teach some form of Nordic shamanism.
Yes.
And you're familiar with the literature and the dreams. Tell us a little bit, give us a bit of an overview of the importance of dreaming in the Norse traditions.
Well, first of all, I don't know if I know more than you do. I am not Scandinavian, first of all. Like you said, I'm Dutch. But I have some family in Norway. And for some reason, when I was young, again, same story, when I was a kid, I just realized where I come from. And not in the chauvinistic way, as if northern people are better than everything else. I just knew where my soul belonged to, or at least a part of my soul, or one of my souls. And so what I did when I was 12, this time I know my age, I put some money aside, and for my own birthday, I bought the Edda, the poetic Edda, and I still have it. It's a long time ago. I just devoured the poems and the myths, not understanding anything, and I copied the runes, which I went like, I know this. I kept on exploring it. I never stopped. I do teach some of it. Last week, I taught a workshop on Seder and on runes. Now, for people who do not know, the runes are basically a writing system that are very angular, because, well, people did not write on paper at that moment. They put it in stone and in wood. The writing probably comes originally from Italy. It was also used for magic. People connected runes with certain concepts, abstract concepts, at the same time that were related to their lives. So it was really alive. It was important to them. A rune like Isa is just basically written like an eye, a vertical line, but it is ice. And ice was important for people, especially in the north. Too much ice, and you can't go out with your boat, or you cannot go hunt, or if the winter takes too long, you cannot sow your crops. There are other runes that basically always relate back to nature, or to a concept, or sometimes to a deity like Tyr, who is a god of war, something you must know, how to deal with conflict. There is a rune Ing, which is for the god of peace, Ing, or also known as Freyr, because, well, you need to know how to deal with peace. Seder is a complicated word. We don't really know what it means. I think so. I see every 10 years somebody coming up with a new explanation. But it is some sort of shamanic type magic. We have a very good story on a person who practices Seder in a saga, a story, where a woman practicing Seder basically acts like a prophetess. She goes into a trance because people are singing specific songs, so there's no shamanic drumming. And while in a trance, people can ask her questions and she can answer a bit like the Oracle of Delphi, but, well, maybe. We don't really know. And actually, practicing Seder, you could be a channel and let the spirits or the ancestors speak through you, something we can see in Asian-type shamanisms. But there are other ways of practicing Seder. Once we go through poems, once we go through sagas, there is Seder for calling the fish into the harbor, which is pretty important. There is Seder for being able to have an influence on other people's minds. Basically, if you go in a state, you're in some sort of a dream state when you practice Seder. Of course, a lot of it is lost, and so when you want to practice it today, you must realize that you cannot do the way the ancestors did. We do not know how they practiced. So we are kind of reconstructing it. We're trying out things. And even if we knew exactly the way the ancestors would practice it, we couldn't do it like them because we are not like them. Our sensibilities are different. Our ethics are different. Like you said, it can be quite dark, the Northern myth and Northern stories and Northern
I hear you, and you're putting that very clearly. But you and I both know that to some extent it is possible to dream our way into ancestral traditions, to find ourselves, for example, by making a shamanic journey or by following the clues that our own dreams give us. Find our way into a culture that is calling to us, and sometimes meet authentic representatives of that culture across time and dimension. So that, I think, to a degree, is open to us. I mean, on a surface level, what you say is absolutely right. But dreamers might have other ways of entering the practice and the situation. It doesn't mean that our brains work exactly the way that theirs did, though they probably don't work all that differently, actually. And when we talk about trying to understand from our present moment in time what people were doing centuries ago, I think about a remarkable social history of dreaming in Iceland that I read. I think the author is Dutch. Dutch turn up everywhere. I don't know whether you've seen this book, but it's the social history. I'm trying to remember the author's name. I think it's Adrian Heinen, a Dutch scholar, The Social Life of Dreams. It is an extraordinary book. It's a history of Icelandic dreams, and she brings up all the sources, but she's been living in Iceland. I think she lives in Sweden now. And she divided her time between Reykjavik and talking to people in modern urban offices and so on, and living on a small farm in a remote situation, and looking at how the farmers dream what the weather's going to be like, whether it's going to be a bad winter, and how the fisher people dream the fish. And as I read her, I'm thinking, well, first of all, Iceland is probably quite different in the sense that dreaming has remained central to the popular culture in a way we probably don't find in other Western countries. But also I'm thinking there's a continuity of approaches to dreaming here, which is very interesting. And the continuity is summed up in the very Icelandic statement that says, I had a dream. I'm probably not going to be able to pronounce it at all, but something, me dreamed drám fyrir, einverju. Anyway, an Icelandic friend of mine, when I confronted her with this appalling mispronunciation, I said, what exactly does this mean? And it means I had a dream, right? No, it doesn't mean I had a dream, she said. It means, really, I dreamed about something. And the implication is I dream for a reason. And the grammatical construction actually means it dreamed me a dream, with the implication it's for a reason. So it dreams, what is it? Something dreams me a dream. So although I can't really tie this up in a neat bow and say this is what we learn, I just found that I'm fascinated by how people, the words and phrases people use to talk about these experiences in different cultures. So here in Icelandic, apparently, is at least according to my Icelandic friend and the scholar I mentioned has something about this too, there is a suggestion that if you dream, it's because something is dreaming with you, for you, and there's a reason for it. So you better pay attention.
Yes, it's something that I found also by doing research into sagas and some myths. Dreams, they choose the people.
All right, we're talking to Willem Hartman. We'll find out how you can contact him when we come back. We're about to take a break, and I'm going to lead or mislead him along a number of trails now I want to talk about, because we're still in the Norse territories and the sagas and the Edda and all of that. I want to talk to him about shapeshifting. I want to talk to him about the many aspects or segments of soul or self in the Nordic tradition. I want to talk to him about how dreams can advise you of coming events within that tradition and, of course, within our own experience. You're listening to Way of the Dream with Robert Moss. We'll be back after a short break.
Robert Moss has a deep engagement with the dream world, and now you can take a crash course from this master of active dreaming at your own pace. That's right, you can get Robert's 8 exciting half-hour programs on a new DVD set called Way of the Dreamer. Share Robert's story as a dreamer and dream healer. This dynamic 3-DVD set can help teach you how to find your way through your dreams to realize your full potential. Don't wait to learn the practical dreamwork techniques that can help you understand how to attain better health, emotional stability, spiritual awareness, and more. Order Way of the Dreamer DVDs today from Amazon.com or MossDreams.com. That's MossDreams.com.
We're HealthyLife.net, reaching and helping a worldwide audience without hype, without shock, and without shenanigans.
All right, this is Way of the Dream with Robert Moss. We're going to go very northern, very north, borrowing from the sagas and the old stories, seeing how they apply to our present lives and how they might also connect us with our soul countries. Willem Hartman, my wonderful guest, talked about our soul places, our soul countries, the places of our soul belonging. And I would say that one of the great gifts of dreams, and also synchronicity, which is dream-like things popping up in everyday life. One of the great gifts of dreams is it guides us towards our soul family, our soul connections, places which sometimes we mightn't even recognize as being part of our soul story, because our soul story is not just the story of DNA and genealogy. It's the story of our multi-dimensional connections. Anyway, a story which seized me when I first read it, I don't think I was 12, but I might have been 19, is in the saga of King Hrolf Kraki. And it's a story of a warrior in a northern country whose name is Budva Bjarki, which means warlike little bear. He's got typical Scandinavian genealogy. His father, Bjorn, could shapeshift into a bear as a result of a curse. His mother's name means she-bear. Anyway, in the story, as I remember it, a battle is going on, and Budva's side is doing well because a giant bear is in their ranks. The other side has a much bigger army, but the giant bear is having no trouble knocking down the warriors on the other side. But then someone, like the king, says, well, where's Bodvar? Why isn't he in the field? And a boy, a squire, perhaps is sent to wake up Bodvar, who seems to be napping. And Bodvar groggily gets out of his hut, and the moment that he comes out of his nap, the bear disappears. And we begin to understand that the bear is his other form. who's taken the field to fight. And Bogdan's a decent warrior. He's a strong and brave man, but he's nothing like the bear that he apparently projected. So now the battle is lost. So that's a summary of the story. And we can go on with that story if you'd like to discuss it, Willem, or we can just take off from it to talk about the interesting subject of shape-shifting as it exists in the traditions that we're looking at, and as a sort of possibility in the history of humanity, and at least energetically, spiritually, in the operations of shamanic dreamers today.
I really loved the saga of Rolf Kraki. It's amazing. It's full of small stories. There's the story of Svipdag in it as well. There are so many things. If I remember well, because I did not see that story for a long time, Bodvar has two brothers. One of them changes into a hound, and another one is an elk, or like a human being, like a were-elk, if you want. I think he walks on two feet, but he has the strength of an elk, and elks are very strong. I think he became a bandit, and his other brother, who is a hound, I think he became the king of Sweden, if I'm not mistaken, because he was so big that he could fill up the throne of Sweden. Because only a person who was big enough to fill up the throne could become the king. They don't want scrawny little people. And the enemy that was being fought on the battlefield, I think his name was King Adils, and I think he came in the shape of a swine, of a boar, a battle boar.
Right.
So it's a very powerful story filled with shape-shifting. To bring this into modern-day practice, to make the connection shamanically and in a Nordic way, in shamanism we can work with the idea of merging. You can merge with your power animal. So if your power animal is a fox, well, when you merge, you basically become fox. But at the same time, you're still yourself. You're not really possessed. A thing I realized lately is that when I practice it, it is much more as if I put on the costume of the power animal, as if I put on the costume of a wolf, and then I become a wolf. I'm thinking of a myth in which the trickster god Loki, he borrows the feather costume of Freya, the goddess of love and war.
Yes.
And at that moment, he becomes a falcon, and he can fly. I'm also thinking of the word berserker. In English, the word to go berserk means to lose all control and feel no pain and become a powerful warrior. Those were powerful warriors, but the word berserker means to put on the shirt of the bear. Ber and serk is shirt. To become a werewolf or to become a wolf person, a wolf man, you were a Ulfhedinn. An Ulf, you can hear in English, is wolf. And Hedinn, if I say it well in Norse, it's close to the Dutch huid, which means skin. Again, you put on the skin, you put on the shape, you put on the form of your power animal or your ally or your totem animal. And this changes your signature, your energy signature, so much that you basically become it. The trick, of course, is not to lose control, which, of course, something werewolf and people who go berserk, they have it to them.
So thank you for explaining that with such clarity. Isn't there are other aspects, perhaps? I mean, one of them would be to project the form of an animal that is your ally from your physical body to do something at a distance. That might be what's going on with Bodvar, mightn't it? Because his physical body is in the hut.
Exactly.
And then, of course, you know, you might be able to project this animal form to do things at a great distance. To run messages or to intercede in a certain situation. I mean, both of us, I think, have seen this happen a lot. But when you go through the old literature, through the sagas and so on, you find again and again that in dreams, someone is seeing what other people are doing in their animal forms. Typically, this is the enemies coming upon you as wolves or something or other. But there are so many stories of this kind, and, you know, and it does make one think about the many possibilities and applications of shapeshifting. I mean, you talked about the berserker, the one who goes berserk in order to have a killing frenzy in battle. By the way, an English author, a Scottish author, Xander Scott, wrote a series of novels about Boudica, sometimes called Boadicea, the ancient Celtic queen of Britain, mm-hmm. and her warriors, who in the novels are called she-bears. And you see ancient Brits beating themselves into a frenzy and running off as berserkers as the she-bears. So there's that. There's the battle application. And there's the healing application. You know, I mean, there might be a theriomorphic healing available if we can call upon a certain kind, the right kind of animal energy, or extend it to someone else. It might, extend to soul recovery.
I think this is a very good term. You just mentioned a morphic healing. Yeah, it could help heal or repair your shape.
I have to tell you this because it's another Dutch story. Sorry to jump in, but I led a workshop in Utrecht a few years ago, and I told people you're going to make this journey and meet your animal doctors. I said specifically, doctors, not animal powers, animal doctors. They're going to work on you during the journey. Liberal academic there, and he came back. He's very excited. He's a very, very taciturn Dutchman to begin with, but then he's rubbing his head and saying, I got hedgehogs. They're on my head, and they were scrubbing and scrubbing. And I said, what? What are you doing? And they said, your head needs to be scrubbed. Put too much in your head. Your head is full of stuff that needs to be scrubbed out. We're all laughing.
Excellent.
He accepted it. He smiled. He smiled, Willem. He was glad to have the hedgehog on his head. We're talking to Willem Hartman. What a wonderful conversation. What a wonderful teacher of shamanic dreaming Willem is. We'll be back to hear more from him after the break. This is Way of the Dreamer with Robert Moss.
Robert Moss has a collection of books, audio, video, and DVD products that will help you bring the creative and healing gift of dreams into your everyday life. Revitalize your work and relationships and journey to the furthest reaches of your imagination. These books are tools that everyone can use to begin or enhance active dreaming in their lives. Visit mossdreams.com. That's mossdreams.com. MOSSDREAMS.com.
You're listening to HealthyLife.net, the radio network that brings positive talk with positive change to make your world a little better.
Talking to Willem Hartman, shamanic dream teacher, a Dutchman by origin, teaches mostly in French, speaks beautiful English, and has a great attraction towards, let's say, the traditions and the practices of the North, the North Icelandic traditions. Willem, I am fascinated by the Norse conceptions of soul, spirit, which are not the right words because they're not really exact translations, but it seems to be that in Norse tradition, there is not a unified self, as we would talk about in English today. Even the word soul might not be exactly right. But there are various components of identity which sort of live together in the house of the body. Some of them come and go with great mobility. They have different names in the tradition. But as always, I understand these things better by direct experience and stories that you can vouch for than by sort of academic attempts to lay them out. So let me introduce this subject, which I'd like to explore with you, the polypsychic, if you like, aspect of Norse identity.
I love that word.
Literature and perhaps amongst people today. So I had a Norwegian coming to stay with me. I was living in a former home. He's a Norwegian-American. He's very Norwegian. And the night before here, he's due to arrive, there's someone in my room moving around, and I look, and it's him, in his, you know, etheric body. Fairly dense, not translucent. I mean, I can see that he's not fully physical, but he's there. And I say, Fred, okay, it's too early. Come tomorrow. Go away. And, of course, you know, I like to think it's not that easy to get access to my private space, but he was invited for the next day. And when he came the next day, we talked about, we used a word in discussion which is apparently well known in Norway, if not elsewhere. It sounds something like vertigo. It means something like forerunner. There is a popular belief, yes, in Norway that before you go anywhere, an aspect of yourself travels ahead of you and might be perceived, yes, by others to be arriving at a certain place before you. There's actually a book written about this by a well-known, you know, Norwegian scientist. Vertigo, our national phantom, of course, like that. So I'm looking at this, and then I'm thinking about it, and thinking, well, I just saw an example of what you find when you read the literature, when you read the sagas and so on, that some part of the person travels outside the body, and amongst other things they might do, they might go ahead of them as a forerunner or scout, or, you know, getting some practice and doing a rehearsal for what's going to follow. What's your take on all of this? I mean, these multiple aspects of self, some of which can shapeshift, some of which can become whales or elks or enormous hounds, and all of that.
Well, my take is it's really subjective and personal. It's based on experience and some of the ideas that I may have now. First of all, to go back to what we just said before the break, is that, yeah, there is the shape, which perhaps we could call with a Norse word a hammer. It's like, yeah, just the shape that the essence of a person is put in. So I think it is totally possible to create like a copy of your shape and to send it or to project it outward. Not unlike actually of what you said about Bodvar Bjarki. The idea of somebody who is like a forerunner, somebody who goes ahead of you, that's something indeed you find in Norse folklore. I can't remember where I read it, but I think I've read it too in a Scottish story, which is not weird because a lot of Vikings settled in what is now the north of Great Britain. There's also the concept of the fylja, if I say it well. I'm sorry for all the Icelandic people what I just said, but I've always read the fylja as a follower. I just made the jump, and that may be something that is coming after you. So it seems as if we can project our shape with some of our energy also that has to go in, some of our essence, that could work like a type of a double within time, both going forward in time as well as going backwards in time. And therefore somebody can observe us before we are in a place. I've actually had that situation with the person I was going to meet. I saw that person before standing in a specific space in Amsterdam a long time ago, like 3 decades ago, and it just happened. So was I clairvoyant, or did the person actually have a forerunner? I don't know. How can I prove either one or the other? it seems indeed that the Norse psyche is not singular, not just one aspect. There is a self, and that's it. There seem to be several things. There is the forerunner, there is the filia, there is the shape, there is also your inspiration. Even the breath is seen as an essential part of the psyche. I did find once the word soul as sal, S-I-L, in literature, but I can't really confirm it.
I read on sal, Willem, I read that the word was introduced by the Christians, but it was not in the tradition until Christianity came. But this word for soul, it was a Christian insertion into a tradition which didn't have the idea. I mean, it's probably too abstruse and too far extended for us to discuss, but it seems that in many, many, many early and indigenous traditions, not only Norse, but anywhere you look, there is not necessarily our modern concept of the self.
The word soul doesn't necessarily apply as we think it might. Often the body seems to be a house of several residents or tenants that come and go. It might also be a house for minor gods. And when you go to, who are some of these characters? You go to ancient Mesopotamian, I won't go there for very long, but to try and understand what the Mesopotamian polypsychic self is like, you've got to understand individual gods and goddesses. I mean, minor ones who are part of the identity of an individual but can get easily kicked off and go away. But that's an individual from any kind of sacred source. So I guess, looping back to your thought earlier about the challenge of understanding cultures and beliefs and practices of early time, I mean, the whole concept of mind and self seems to be different in the older societies, and that is challenging for us. I mean, we can accept that we have many aspects, and we might not, like Jung say, we've got to practice individuation and bring these different aspects together, or we might accept a simple model like Freud with the ego and superego. But most of us in modern society don't have this concept of the polypsychic self as four or more different soul entities or something like that. But it's typical in indigenous societies, and I think that Norse tradition is similar to that. And it sets up mysteries and challenges and adventures.
Yes. To expand on that, or I'm thinking about a dream I had once where I was a falcon flying in the sky. I can actually still feel it when I connect to it. I remember also dreams of being a wolf, but the falcon one was really powerful. And from what you call a polypsychic point of view, that makes sense. Why? I don't think it's impossible that in another reality or in another time frame, or in a way I just cannot explain right now, I am actually a falcon, while at the same time right now I'm a human being on the phone talking to Robert Moss.
Right.
This is one of the thoughts I had when I decided to take my dreams and my nightmares not as a problem, but pragmatically as actually something that enriches my life when I was young. Realizing that in all those different dreamscapes in which we can go, where you're in a different city, you're in a different landscape, you're with different people, you may actually be living those lives. It is not just in your head. As you said in one of your books, it's not just a dream.
I love what you said about being a falcon in another world. I hereby declare you, in the language of Viveres de Castro, leading Brazilian anthropologist, I declare you definitely a multinatural perspectivist. What I want to do is to congratulate you on living as well as leading and teaching a road of direct experience. These things are too important and too interesting for us to take them, you know, the second-hand hand-me-downs. I mean, I read immensely. I think Quillen does too. But at the end of the day, I want to check and verify everything I can by the road of direct revelation, direct experience, which is what our approach, I think I can put us together in this, our approach to shamanism and dream all about is the path of direct experience. Check it out for yourself. You want to know about the soul? Well, check it out. You want to know what happens to the soul after death? Well, check it out for yourself. Here's how you do it. And as Willem will teach you, and as I will also, in my approach to what I call chiromancy, which is my made-up word for the practice of synchronicity, remember that you can dream with your eyes open and all your senses a quiver, as well as with your eyes closed. We'll be back for one final segment, unfortunately, because I'm enjoying it so much, with Willem Hartmann after the break, and we'll have to get Willem to give us contact information, because I know many of you might want to be in touch with him. You're listening to Way of the Dreamer with Robert Moss.
Robert Moss has a collection of books, audio, video, and DVD products that will help you bring the creative and healing gift of dreams into your everyday life. Revitalize your work and relationships and journey to the furthest reaches of your imagination. These books are tools that everyone can use to begin or enhance active dreaming in their lives. visit mossdreams.com. That's mossdreams.com. MOSSDREAMS.com.
HealthyLife.net, where positive overcomes negative.
We are talking to Willem Hartman. What a wonderful teacher and practitioner of dreamwork and shamanism he is. Willem, people are going to want to find you. How can they find you online?
I've got a website. You just type my name and you'll find it.
So it's W-I-L-L-E-M, Hartman with one N.
Yeah, you can do that. Totally.
All right, you'll find
Absolutely.
Him. He's findable and he's worth finding. Well, there's so much more we might talk about, but let's stay in Nordic territory, Norse territory, for a little bit longer. I made myself a list after doing a certain amount of work on all of this of insights and practices that we might derive from Norse traditions of dreaming, not Seder, but or runes, but dreaming per se, going through the 500 plus dream reports in Norse literature and other sources in the social history of Ireland. One of the things that I wrote down, which I think will appeal to people as an idea, is do not date someone who doesn't dream. Don't go out with someone who doesn't dream. And you may remember where this comes from. It's the story of Thyri, Harald's Dottir, daughter of Earl in Holstein, which I think is not geographically in Scandinavia, but near enough, it's a Norse story. She's being courted by the King of Denmark, and who asks for her hand in marriage from the father. And Thyri's father, who respects her as a proud, independent woman, says, oh, no, you'll have to ask her directly. And Thyri says to the man who's courting her, who is a king of Denmark, says, well, I'm not going to talk to you. I'm not going to date you. I'm not going to marry you until you dream. And you'll do this by building yourself a special shelter to dream in. And he dreams, and he brings her the dreams of three knights, and they get married, and the dreams forecast what's going to happen, you know, through the weather and through invasions and all that kind of thing. So I love this story involving the daughter of a nobleman and a king, which says, don't trust or date someone who doesn't dream. I mean, I don't know how widespread that concept is in Nordic culture, but it's a good story.
I find it wise. I find it very wise.
Yeah. What do you dream?
Story.
What have you dreamed?
Yeah.
What do you dream? That's a good question to ask anybody, really. Do you dream? What do you dream? Well, go and dream on this. You want to take
me out?
It
would be a bit hard to tell them. If they say they don't dream, it would be a bit hard to tell them, well, in that case, I don't speak to you.
Well, it's not clear whether this King of Denmark was a dreamer until she told him to go dream, but he did all the things she told him, which involved dream incubation in the special sense of setting up a special place, and indeed even building a place to dream in. Something else is really not so much an insight as a mood in the Norse literature of dreaming, and I'm really talking about the historical literary stuff now more than my experience with contemporary.
Yes.
I've taught in Scandinavia a few times. I didn't notice this in the attitudes of contemporary Swedes or Norwegians or Danes, not really, or Sami. I had some Sami in my workshops in Sweden. Mm-hmm. But when you read the literature, there's a certain kind of deterministic, fatalistic, you know, mood to it quite often. You dream things, and they're going to play out. You might have difficulty reading the symbolism because somebody's going to show up as a falcon or an eagle or a whale or a walrus rather than in their human guise. But things happen, often horrible things, and it seems that nothing could be done about it except just to be stoically prepared for what the dream is showing you and ready to face it. I mean, that's a mood in the literature, which I find a bit somber. And it leads us to think about how different societies, different cultures approach fate. To what extent can fate be changed? To what extent is fate fixed? What's your feeling about this in general, living with that culture and practicing some elements of that culture? How fatalistic, how deterministic would you say is this Northern tradition?
You know, for me, Northern tradition is more than just Scandinavia. I think the Dutch, I studied the Germanic people. The thing is that the Norse, they have all the sagas. They have a lot of material because they were Christianized quite late. You're absolutely right to say that it's very fatalistic. There is a concept called the Wyrd, the W-Y-R-D. It's hard to understand. It is probably related to the modern English word, weird, like odd. It seems that everything is connected. It's very animistic. Everything is connected. There is a soul behind everything, and it's the things are just set the way they are. So there are very famous stories in sagas, like in Njál saga, in Gísla saga, where somebody has a dream or several dreams, and they can't change it. It is going to happen. So if somebody dreams that they're going to be in battle and they're going to be killed, it will happen. And the weird as a concept or as a, some sort of a spiritual mechanism, it is completely amoral. There's nothing you can do. Good or bad, pleasant or unpleasant, it's going to happen. So a lot of people, they kind of resign to it, but at the same time, they face it. They face it with determination. And even if you may lose in battle or you will have an accident or something terrible may happen, it usually ends up really bad. Your honor will be remembered, and people will sing songs on your name, and that's something that people took comfort in.
Yeah, as you mentioned, Gisli saga, of course, is very popular in Scandinavia, and I wrote down, I was just looking up my notes, I wrote down something that Gisli, outlaw and dreamer, declares in his saga, quote, "Fates must find someone to speak through. Whatever is meant to happen will happen." So I'm just confirming what you're saying. I mean, in this culture pattern, you know, what you see is somehow determined, but then at the same time, who is the speaker going to be? And which, of course, raises the question when we think about how people share stories. What do you tell other people? I mean, if you see an evil event in your dream, do you want to tell people about it or not? I mean, if you don't tell it, is it less likely to happen? How does that work? I'm not clear on what the Scandinavian response to that is, but different cultures have different patterns. Some cultures say, if you see something bad in your dream, don't talk about it. Some say, well, just don't talk about it, go and spit it out. And some say, well, do talk about it, because it will scatter the energy. So there are different strategies. But I like the idea of weird as I understand it. I like the idea that there are threads of connection between all things. If you find the right place to sit, somehow at the center of the pattern, you could tug, pull on those strings, you know, as that's the Norns are doing or trying to do, and change things for the better. I'm very restless when I find myself under the shadow of a deterministic philosophy, because whatever seems likely to happen, I want to see whether we can change the odds on it manifesting. So perhaps I'm leaning towards Loki on this front, certainly towards the fox.
I'm very uncomfortable with it as well, when things are too deterministic and too fatalistic. So when I teach dreaming, when I teach shamanism, neo-shamanism, and when there is, we're talking about the subject is northern shamanism, I tell people, okay, this is how Nordic ancestors lived it, but we don't have to do it like this. The weird for us is maybe not the same as the weird it was for our ancestors. And there are always ways to negotiate. There's always something to learn. One of the things also I like to tell is the story of a man goes out hunting. No, a man has a dream that he goes out hunting and he's killed by a bear. And he tells his wife in the morning, and she says, I know what to do. So they go out in the garden. She takes a bear skin, pretends to be the bear, throws a stick at him, not too big, of course, doesn't want to hurt him, then some ketchup on him, and he pretends that he is dead. And now they say, okay, what you dreamt of wasn't a bear killing you. What you dreamt of was the theater, the play, the scene we just did. So this, without... I can't. You can't tell your students, hey, listen, all your dreams are fatalistic. Because in that case, all my nightmares when I was a kid.
Seized with excitement by this story. Is this something that actually happened? Was this actually play-acted like that?
I have no idea. I think maybe
you heard the story. Well, the reason that I'm so interested
is... I think I got it from you.
The point is that there are such performances. And they're culturally entrenched in some traditions. In the Iroquoian Indian tradition, for example, which I know about, it was a traditional method of averting or containing the event in an evil dream, to act it out, but stop short of the possibly lethal or most brutal consequences of the dream. So a Mohawk war captain dreams that he is fire tortured to death amongst the ruins of his village as a result of an enemy attack. And he asks the village people to tie him to a stake, burn his flesh with red-hot axes and knives, play-act the dream, more than catch it, play-act the dream, but of course stop short of killing and destroying the village, in the hope that this will play out the dream and the rest of it doesn't have to happen. And I've actually led informal rituals within families that were faced with a situation where something bad might happen and couldn't by ordinary means get away from that scenario, but by play-acting think that they might have saved themselves. So when you told me that story, which of course might be one of mine, but I couldn't remember the catch-up, I recognized a pattern, an apotropaic pattern. Apotropaic means turning away evil, which has been followed in certain traditions. Very interesting stuff. So if you don't like the future... don't give up on being able to change it.
Absolutely. I'm sorry, I cut you. I have done this with a group, with a person who had a nightmare of a plane crashing. And so the group was rather big, 20 people, and we just, some person played the pilot, another person played the plane, the mountain, and we just played it. We had a lot of fun. It was a bit silly at one moment, but they took away all the energy. And, well, the person in question wasn't scared anymore to go and take the plane. And, of course, there was no plane crash. So, yeah, we've done that. And it's quite therapeutic. It's very good.
Yes, yes. Well, of course, that brings another element which we both enjoy, which is performance. I mean, acting out the dream. And there's shamanic theater, and then there's spontaneous dream theater, in which we take something someone has dreamed. I mean, it can be wildly funny. One of my workshops over here, we had a woman who dreamed that her ex-husband captured her and put her in a pizza oven and left her there to die. At the end of the dream, she didn't feel too good. We dreamed it. We had the pizza oven performed by people's bodies. We had the ex-husband. We had her in the pizza oven. And, of course, she added to the story. It didn't end with her being left. It was acted out beyond that. We had acted scenes and chapters, and we had this incredible good humor and bonded energy of the group doing that. Such fun. Well, I'm sorry, Willem, that we seem to have reached a point where you and I can't be in each other's gatherings having fun of this kind, but it's been great fun to talk to you in this show.
Yes.
We'll be back to say thank you and dream on after the next break. You've been listening to Willem Hartman with me, Robert Moss, on Way of the Dreamer.
HealthyLife.net, where positive overcomes negative.
Well, thank you for joining us. Thank you, Willem Hartman, for all that you do and for the wonderful stories and experiences that you shared. May your best dreams come true.
Yeah, same to you, Robert. Thank you so much for inviting me. It's a pleasure to talk to you. And, dream on.
Well, to everybody, may your best dreams come true. And, of course, may you remember them.